Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owl Post for the week is freshly delivered, and I am one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing. And with me, as she is always, the just wonderfully talented and just incredibly awesome Drea Kaufman.
Incredibly tardy Drea Kaufman.
Hey, you know what, though? When you have a kid, things happen, right?
Yeah, like you get buried underneath her while she watches Moana.
See? I mean.
Priorities.
Yeah, exactly. You're welcome.
Oh, man, I've heard that song like a million times.
Oh, man, I bet. You know, I just like the you can hear from parents the kind of the horror stories of their kid only wanting to watch one thing for months on end. And it's that same thing over and over and over. So, yeah, I'm glad that my wife doesn't like to do that.
It could be worse, though. I mean, she picked a decent movie that I don't mind rewatching. It's not like I have to rewatch Frozen or something along those lines where I just can't watch this or listen to the song again. Like,
yeah, that makes sense.
It could be worse.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, the songs are actually really good in Moana and the story's good. And so, yeah, and it's got The Rock in it. How can you go wrong?
I know. And it's a lot of the songs are written by the guy who did Hamilton. So there you go. How else can you go wrong?
There you go. So
I'll take it.
Well, apparently we can't go wrong, Drea, because we have 2 5-star reviews that had come in there on Apple Podcasts. And we want to say thank you to The Second Brother. They said, 5 stars, this is the best. I absolutely love your voices and the clip at the beginning. I love you, which is awesome. And then the second review, now they have a name that I don't really know. It's question mark, exclamation point, question mark, apostrophe, B-B-B-B. That's their name on iTunes, so... Thank you for, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. I don't know how you would pronounce that. But they said, a great coincidence for me, 5 stars. I found this podcast the week it finished The Goblet of Fire, episode 94. I've slow binged this podcast over 3 months, just like I devoured the books when I bought the 4-pack at Costco a year ago. The hosts are genuine in their discussion of the source materials and take great care to dissect the details I missed on many of my rereads. Great podcasts. So 2 5-star reviews there. That's awesome.
Thanks.
Feels so special.
I do too. It really made my day.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing that. We really appreciate when people go over to iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and give us ratings and reviews. It really does help the show grow. You know, we've been growing by leaps and bounds. I feel like each week we're getting more and more listeners, and so we really appreciate that. So go over to one of those places, Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whichever one you're using, and hit us up with that star rating and written review. Otherwise, you can also make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts, because the moment that the show drops, you'll get the episode. You can find us on Twitter at @JoinNerdParty. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. Maybe you would like to send us an email. Go over to thenerdparty.com/contact. Choose a show. Choose Outpost, and that email would come to Drea and I. And make sure you do check out The Nerd Party for all of the podcasts that come your way. We would love for you to check all of the podcasts out there on thenerdparty.com. So, Drea, this week we have the Sorting Hat's new song in Chapter 11, which is pretty fantastic. But I really, really enjoy the way that this chapter starts, because it starts with some contemplation by Harry, thinking about how he doesn't really want to let others know that he and Luna are having the same hallucination, so he lets it go about the weird horses pulling the carriages.
I feel like he knows he's already got like an uphill battle. Why make it harder on himself?
Well, and I think you're absolutely, I mean, like, nobody else can see these but me and Luna. And it does raise an interesting question. You know, he thinks to himself, like, why is it that we are the only two who can see that? And why can't Ron see it? And why am I just now able to see them? So we really do have a very interesting a somewhat small mystery about, you know, what's pulling the carriages. So I think that's really fun.
I mean, it's a little mini mystery that's sort of woven in that probably isn't super significant, but gives us something to look forward to being answered as we sort of move into the year of Hogwarts, if you will. This is one of the books where we spend a lot of time, several chapters actually, before we even get to Hogwarts. Where in the past, usually by chapter 3 or 4-ish, we're at Hogwarts, guys. So, sort of a long lead up to something that we're all really looking forward to. And it adds more mystery. So we have this mystery of these horses and why he can't see them. And then the mystery that we had kind of carrying over from last chapter is why Professor Grubbly Plank was greeting the first years. And then as we approach the castle, you know, we notice that Hagrid's hut is not lit and he doesn't appear to be home. So we're kind of adding little mystery of little mystery on little mystery here before we even kind of get to the meat of the chapter.
Yeah, it was really fascinating this week. I actually was reading an article with some quotes from JK where she was talking about the reason that this book had such an extended period of time before they get to school was that this book, she had so much to do with Harry and she needed him to be visiting all of these different places throughout the book. And therefore, you know, just the opening to the book was much longer than, you know, had been done before. And so she was even talking about how, you know, if she went back now, she would probably prune all the books a little bit, but she challenged really anybody to find places where you could take out too much from this book because people complained it was too long and stuff. And I think she's right. I think, you know, as I reread these books over and over again, I find the deliberateness, especially in this book, to be quite clear. And so, you know, that you need all of these little things to happen so that they build up into the whole that we get by the end of it. So definitely think that's something important. And like you're mentioning here, we're kind of adding these little mysteries upon little mysteries throughout the story here that will play out by the end of the book. And so, and I loved the fact that this whole thing about Hagrid, you know, Luna's like, because they're talking about Hagrid not being there. He's like, oh, he's not a very good teacher, is he? And I love that Ron, Harry, and Ginny get real angry, like, oh, yes, he is. And Harry's glaring at Hermione because she's not saying anything. And she's like, oh, yeah, he's really good. And Luna just matter-of-factly is like, yeah, well, we all kind of think he's a joke over in Ravenclaw. And like, it was just, there's such this difference between, you know, these, this small group where, you know, Hagrid has kind of found their way into his hearts because they have a personal relationship with him. And I think that's so interesting, too, because it says a lot about, you know, when you have a personal relationship with somebody as to when you don't spend any time with somebody, and so you kind of just judge them based on their cover, you know, like, and on the outside, Hagrid is kind of sometimes buffoonish, right? And yet we understand where that comes from because we know him.
Right. And for me, Hagrid teaches sort of this core trio more than like your standard like teacher teaching, right? Like they learn from him beyond just like his classes. So for them, he is a great teacher, but just not in the way that, you know, Luna or even you could argue any of the Ravenclaws are really looking for. You know, they're looking for your traditional educational instructor, and he is, you know, he is not. He is, you have to learn from him in different ways. So, you know, for them, it truly is a good teacher and a kind person and a friend, and they wouldn't want to see anything happen to him. But, you know, from an educational standpoint, I think it could be argued he is not the greatest teacher.
Well, and part of that, too, is I think that Hagrid kind of lacks the ability to find a constructive way to pass on his enthusiasm, you know, for these things. And that's part of being a good teacher, and he doesn't quite have that. And yet, I mean, when you look at him, you can very much tell that he's very enthusiastic about the idea of magical creatures and treating them with respect. And, you know, in many ways, I think he has a lot of characteristics with Newt that we see in, you know, the Fantastic Beasts series, where he loves magical creatures. He just kind of lacks the ability to communicate to others succinctly and realistically a way and
convincingly
to pass that on. And so, you know, I think we kind of see a connection there, and it's kind of nice actually that you kind of see these two people. But I also the way they connect, but I also think it's fun because, you know, it allows us to see also the way in which Hagrid and somebody like Harry and somebody like Newt all have this connection of being people who understand what it's like to be on the outside looking in, you know, and they're all those type of characters that are really kind of outsiders. And we even see Harry experiencing that, because the moment they get to the castle and they're entering the hall, like everybody's like whispering and like looking at Harry and all of these things. And Harry can just like feel that pressure on him. And it really gets to him throughout this entire chapter. Harry really struggles with this fact of people just pointing and staring and whispering behind his back. And I can't blame him. It would be awful.
Well, and I feel like it's reminiscent of the very beginning in the very first book, where people are pointing and staring, maybe in a more positive manner, but it's still that attention and that fame that from the beginning he's never wanted. And now it's sort of malicious and, you know, not kind in its intent. So we've gone from, it's both the thing he dislikes most in the most unfriendly manner. I can't imagine that anyone in his position would be terribly excited to be at school. You know, it's all, and especially considering he feels like it's his safe haven, and now he instantly sort of feels like he's on the defensive. It's kind of, what's interesting is it's kind of like books one and two together. He gets the pointing and the staring in one. He gets the false accusations of being the heir in two. Now we've sort of amped these similar things up into like an adult version of that, or a teenage version of that. And it's just, it's unpleasant all around. And I can't blame him for not being super excited for this to happen to him.
I like the way you put that, the way that this kind of combines a lot of the different books and Harry's experiences all in one. And we can kind of see this book is Harry's perfect storm. You know, he's kind of...
perfect crap storm.
Yeah, he's kind of caught in the wizarding Bermuda Triangle of awfulness here, where everything just seems to continually go wrong. And, you know, one of the things they talk about was like, well, Harry and Ron and Hermione, like, maybe Hagrid's not back because, well, we know he was sent on a mission with, from Dumbledore. Maybe he's just not finished with that mission. So maybe that's why he's not back. And Ron's like, oh, yeah, that could be it. And Hermione's just kind of like biting her lip, like, I don't know if that's it, you know. But they don't want to upset Harry. And I also think they're all trying to find reasons, good reasons, you know, why Hagrid is probably okay, you know, because I think they all, even Hermione, they all kind of are worried about Hagrid's well-being, because they are, like we said earlier, they're friends with him. So, you know, it's interesting because there's a lot about this moment of getting back to Hogwarts where Harry's thinking to himself, you know, I'm not feeling like as comfortable as normal, but the moment, even with everything that he's had going on with Dumbledore, he sees Dumbledore sitting there and it makes him feel more comfortable. Like the fact that Dumbledore is there, it just gives him a level of comfort for a moment, which I thought that was really interesting, that there's something about Dumbledore's presence that makes Harry relax just for a moment.
There is. And I hope that a lot of people can kind of relate to that and have someone in their life that, even if they're sort of angry or on the outs with, that even just sort of seeing them or being there, you know, a parent or a colleague or, you know, a mentor or something, that when they come into your life, you sort of have this instant ability to relax and trust that what's going to, you know, that they're in control and this is going to be fine. And I feel like that's kind of what happens here. He can be angry and upset with the fact that, you know, Dumbledore's kind of kept him on the outs and he's confused and wants to know more. But at the same time, just his mere presence is comforting that he's still in control. He's still there. He hasn't given up on them. You know, he still seems to have an idea of what's going on. And there's just sort of this blanketed trust that Harry has to sort of just go with. And I don't think that the giant feast hurt either.
No, it doesn't. Although there is a little bit of a disruption in the fact that Umbridge is at the teacher's desk, which, you know.
Harry's not pleased to see her and is confused. And we learn a little later on in the chapter a little more about why she's there. I feel like Hermione kind of knows just based on her reaction, because she's kind of like, no, say it's not true. Oh, it can't be. Oh, you know, like she knows why she's sitting there. The giant plate full of steak and kidney pie and Treacle's heart couldn't have hurt Harry feeling a little bit better. I mean, I feel better when I have a giant stomach full of yummy foods.
It's very true. Well, and then, you know, it's time for the song. We actually get a song, and it's the first time in a long time that we get one. But I think what makes it really interesting is that the hat actually tells a story. And he tells us the story about how the school was founded and how the four friends, they came together, and that, you know, they really were friends. Like Gryffindor and Slytherin were good friends. Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw were good friends. And the four of them made this, like, you know, little posse together. And they decided they wanted to start this school so they could pass on their knowledge. And they had this idea, you know, that they would each have their own houses so they could teach the students that they wanted to teach. We kind of learn, you know, obviously what those were, you know, with Slytherin wanting the pure bloods, and Ravenclaw wanting the really intelligent, and Gryffindor wanting those who were brave, and Hufflepuff saying, hey, I'll teach anybody, you know. So basically, I guess it almost seems like she gets the leftovers, but
I just felt like it was that she'll take those who don't fit in those categories, which aren't the leftovers, but there's a lot that isn't covered there.
It's very true.
And I always loved the idea that Hufflepuffs were the loyal ones, right? They're the they're the sort of, like, I don't know, I always thought of them as more of the morally guided ones, and I always liked that. I always thought of it as that was, it's not the leftovers, but it's, you know, maybe those who are have talents elsewhere beyond the ones that, the three things that were identified, one of which is out of everyone's control.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. When we think about some of the Hufflepuffs we've seen, you know, in many ways, isn't, you know, somebody like Cedric a combination of them all? You know, so in many ways, you know,
he's just not outstanding in any one area,
right?
Because he's sort of outstanding in all of them. Well, we don't know if he was a pureblood, nor does it really matter,
right?
But you know, he was brave, and he was, you know, maybe wasn't super smart, but he was smart enough, and, you know, that sort of thing. So he possessed all of those characteristics, just not in a way that was, like, over and above any other characteristic that he had. So,
no, I agree. You know, I think you're absolutely right, and so I really appreciate that about the Hufflepuff characters, and again, from what we, you know, see in them. And so,
but yes, unfortunately the song paints them as the leftovers.
It does. The song does. But it's really interesting, because we learn about how, you know, they remained friends, but this discord creeps in with the friends, and basically it seems to really kind of turn into a fight between the three and Slytherin, and Slytherin leaves. And so once he was gone, you know, things kind of began to crumble. And what the most interesting thing here, and I wanted to ask you, because this is the part where the hat not only tells a story, but he starts to give advice and saying that, I think it's wrong that I split you up into groups. And I think it's still wrong to do so, even though I must, because that's my purpose. But he says, a warning is that, you know, every time Hogwarts is really in danger from external foes, we must unite from within. And we need to be careful, because if we continue to let things divide us, we'll crumble. And I thought that was so interesting that he connects the idea of splitting up the students with the idea of a way in which you can fracture a group artificially. And especially since, too, because one of the four houses left, I mean, the foundation is not as strong in the sense that, you know, Slytherin left and therefore created a vacuum and made a much, you know, shakier foundation. You know, when you had the four pillars there, you have a very strong foundation, but now you only have three, really, because the Slytherins are so separate in many ways. And so I just thought that was a really interesting, you know, the hat itself makes one of the most interesting thematic elements, which is kind of strange for this entire book. Are we going to be separate, or are we going to find a way to come together, even though we don't always all agree completely on things? And I thought, to me, this makes this book even more relevant today than ever before. But I mean, do you agree with the idea that, you know, there is something wrong with splitting the students up into these different houses? Should they, I mean, when I think about this, you know, is there a point in future history of Hogwarts where we maybe should stop splitting students up in the houses and just, I mean, I don't know how school would work, but, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
I've been really pondering this while you've been kind of explaining, and it's interesting to think about, because I think that there's validity in the concern. And I think that we've seen that in real life and historically, that it just creates animosity. It creates, you know, discord, like you've mentioned, across different groups. You know, the idea that separate is not equal. And then there's the logistics part and the operational part and the pragmatic viewpoint that is going through my head and going, I don't know how it would run otherwise. You have to divide them somehow, because corralling and aligning and scheduling massive groups is much harder than if you split them into smaller groups and then divide them up. But I feel like the issues that come from the division and the discord, I feel like is a failure of leadership. It's the fact that there are different intentions behind each group or behind each house, to me, is why they shouldn't be divided. You should divide them, but not based on characteristics, right? Like, who cares if you're smarter or braver? You know, maybe the division should be a combination of things versus a division along these lines. But I do feel like part of that is a failure of leadership, either the founders of the house or the heads of house or whatever, to continue to drive this point that you need to stand together and not separate. Because, you know, the hat makes a great point that the only way you are successful is when you stand together. And when you stand up as a, you know, don't turn on each other, that's just the core of any sort of movie or story or historical event, is when people stand together and look beyond themselves to the greater good, that's how we accomplish great things. And that's how we sort of survive terrible situations, is when we don't turn on each other and destroy ourselves from within. So it makes a great point and a great warning. And I appreciate that in this moment and at this time, that this sort of, I want to say entity, because I don't really know what you want to call the hat, can see that and can understand and provide such insight that is probably lost on 90% of the people who have heard that. So I hope that that warning is heeded at some point. But I do find it, I'm sort of on the fence. I agree that in this time, maybe it shouldn't happen, but I feel like if it needs to happen, there's still ways that you could support the unity at the school level. But unfortunately, I have a feeling that's not going to happen. So Maybe I didn't directly answer your question there.
No, I think you did.
But that's the ramblings that are going on in my head right now.
I totally think you did, because I was thinking about what you're saying, and my thought was this, is that, you know, there's nothing wrong with good, healthy competition, you know, because that is good for us as human beings. We strive to be better because we compete, you know, well.
It gives us benchmarks. Mm-hmm. It gives us new things to hit. It gives us new challenges and learning opportunities to learn how to do things better or more efficiently or stronger or smarter. So I agree. Competition, I think, is a healthy amount of competition can be very, you know, beneficial to us as people.
Well, and I think the other thing I was also mulling over was the idea that there's nothing wrong with looking at a student and being able to recognize their unique talents and bringing those talents out, which is what I think three of the houses are doing. They're actually looking at the internal talents of a student and saying, hey, we want to foster those because that's good for a person to bring out those natural talents and accentuate them. Whereas, you know, I hate to put it all on Slytherin, but Slytherin's point is to pull out something that has nothing to do with talent. It has all to do with something nobody can control other than people who are obsessed with pure bloodness. And that's really what it comes down to, which that's where the real separation becomes. And it really does start to create this distinction between the students to which they couldn't naturally control. It has nothing to do with their talent. It has to do with something that is beyond their control.
Well, and I think it creates a situation similar to, and I'm not going to take sides or state opinions here because I don't want to open a can of worms with this, but this is something I have always viewed in the pro-life versus pro-choice argument. You're not arguing two opposing sides. You're arguing different arguments, both of which are valid, have validity, and both of which can be argued, but you're never going to come to a resolution because you're not arguing the same thing. So I feel like that's similar here. You're arguing talents, skills, attributes that can be sort of grown and expanded on and catered to, and then something that isn't the same. They're not the same. You know, you've got three kinds of apples and one orange, and you can't compare them, and they can't work together because they're not the same thing. So I think that is part of the issue with the four houses, is if you replace Slytherin with something else, which I believe now that she's sort of established Pottermore and continuing with this idea of houses, that Slytherin has kind of evolved in that sense from pure blood to, I think it's natural talent is what they use on Pottermore now, is that if you're sorted into Slytherin, it has to do with this natural talent that you have, and that becomes more, again, an attribute that you can work with and adapt and grow and glean versus, you know, you can't change how you're born or what you're born with, but you can grow this talent that you kind of have. So I appreciate that distinction now that we are kind of continuing on this tradition in the, you know, internet realms. But I do think that part of the problem is that we don't have the same thing. We're not dealing with the same subject matter here. So it's hard to bring everyone on the same page since they're not even in the same book.
What I think is, interesting too, because this whole thing ties into this idea of that we need to find a way to unite, because Hogwarts is facing external danger. And if we don't unite, will crumble from within and then we'll lose everything. And I think there's a real beauty and validity to that idea, is that, look, regardless of our separate differences, there are things that unite us, and we need to find out what it is that unites us so that we can be strong together. And that doesn't mean, you know, perfectly agreeing all the time or all those kind of things. But we need to be able to find a way to come together. And you know, when I read this book in light of the landscape of the world that we live in, you know, we're allowing too many things to divide us instead of finding ways to unite. You know, what makes us come together instead of what makes us different? And that's what the hat is saying. You know, you need to find the ways to come together, or else you will crumble. You know, everything.
Well, and you need you need to find that greater good beyond yourself.
Right.
You need to look at what is best for everyone in the long run and not just what is best for you, which again, in this political climate, at the time that we're recording this, I think we are just coming out of one of the longest U.S. government shutdowns ever, because no one could look past themselves and do what's best for the greater good. And you can argue both sides there as well. But, you know, the greater good is not being, you know, acknowledged by some of our biggest leaders in our country. And so as you're seeing, the entire infrastructure of our country is dissolving, and we have, you know, a million people who are unable to pay their bills or eat or support their families. So, you know, we are missing the point. We're missing what the whole point of our structure is. And I think that that's what the Sorting Hat is warning of. You know, don't just focus on you and what you want and what you think is right, but look at the greater picture and say, how do we come together? Where are we alike? Where are our interests aligned, and how do we stand together from that perspective and understand that this is bigger than one person?
It is pretty cool too, because we learn from, you know, the ghosts, you know, Nearly Headless Nick has a conversation with Harry, telling him, you know, because Harry's like, I can't remember the hat ever giving advice. And we learn from him that the hat has given advice before, and that they give advice from the fact that whenever he thinks that Hogwarts is in danger. So I thought that that was a really nice thing, that we kind of get some interaction with the ghosts. I always love when we get that. And you know, the fact that he's like, well, you know, we ghosts coexist peacefully. And is like, I would never dream of arguing with the Bloody Baron. And Ron's like, that's because you're terrified of him. But I just thought that that was just a fun little moment where we get confirmed that this isn't the first time the hat's done this, that in the years that Hogwarts has existed, you know, and it's been around for a very long time, that this has happened before. And so I think that, you know, the fact that Nearly Headless Nick gives us that idea lets us know that, you know, this doesn't happen all the time. This is a very, it seems like a pretty rare occasion for the hat to give a warning. So something's going down and everybody needs to pay attention.
And I really love that the explanation, and especially when we ask, like, how does it even know what's happening? It's a hat. Like, how does it know beyond its own, like, realm what's going on? And, you know, that Nearly Headless Nick says, you know, it sits in Dumbledore's office all day. It gleans things. It hears things. It senses things. You know, you get this idea that, you know, there is more and more seriousness going on. This is just, again,
right,
more
right.
Like fuel on that fire, that there is some, that like poop is about to hit the fan. Like it, like we are on the brink of something, that we have an idea, but we're not quite sure what it looks like yet, but we all should be absolutely terrified right now. So it's just, it like even drives home that point more that she's been slowly building through the first, you know, six chapters of this book. So it's really, I appreciated the explanation of how it even knows this. It's not like some weird all-knowing entity. It sits in Dumbledore's office all day. And I was like, oh, that's a very straightforward and reasonable explanation. All right, I'll take it.
Well, and the little tiny moment that happens is Dumbledore's giving the, you know, the announcements, and how he's like, you know, that the forest in the grounds is out of bounds to students. And a few of the older students might know that now too. And how Ron, Harry, and Hermione look at each other and kind of smirk like, eh.
Yeah, he's talking to us.
It's great. It's a great moment. And then, of course, we get Dumbledore being interrupted by Professor Umbridge to give a speech. And I absolutely adore the fact that the moment she starts speaking, Harry is glancing around, and how like nobody looks happy. And he's like, maybe that's because we're all being addressed as if we're like five. And that annoys, you know, every one of us completely. And then the speech she gives pretty much puts everybody to sleep. Except for Hermione, who is listening very intently, and she gives us the lowdown, which is, yeah, Hogwarts is being, you know, influenced now by the ministry. The ministry is here to interfere, and that's what's about to happen. And it's like, okay, this makes sense now why the hat just gave that warning. Because, yeah, things are about to go down at Hogwarts this year, and it's not going to be the same Hogwarts that we knew. And so I think that's fascinating that we immediately have confirmed through Hermione from the speech what's going down.
I feel like Umbridge's speech and the way it's sort of written, because the way she writes it is great. She'll give you a line and then she just goes and she rambles on for a while and then she gives you another line and then she rants. Like, she doesn't write out this giant rambly speech that we have to read, right? She literally gives us a few key points we need to know and then gives us the Harry version, right? Where we're only listening to a few things and the rest is just nonsense, right? It's like listening to Charlie Brown, adults in Charlie Brown. But I do love what she does with this mechanism, in that Umbridge, she could have very straightforward come forth, delivered what she needed to share in like 5 sentences, right? But instead she drones on for like 15 or 20 minutes. I think it's pretty excessive like that. And she fills it with just nonsense and overly political things. And really all she has to say is that, we don't like the way you've been taught. We have new curriculum. The ministry feels like we need this to be a better, you know, the ministry is disappointed in Dumbledore and wants you to have a better education, period. Like, she could have said that, but instead she wrapped it in this political BS bow that took, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes, however long it took. And that, to me, she's just JK's own diatribe about, you have to, like, just get to the point. Just say what you mean, be impeccable with what you have to say. And like, it's just all, it just, to me, she just has this, it's just this little like icing on the political BS sundae. Like, she is just, it's a scathing indictment of political speaking. Like, that's exactly what I took from this. And then, and why this was necessary in a school. It was so outlandish that she's just portraying it as the ridiculous manner in which it really is. And that is how I have, every time I've read this, every time I've heard this part in the movie, it is her indictment and how much she hates political speak.
Well, and not only that, but there's a very interesting connection here with a C.S. Lewis essay called The Abolition of Man, which is how he was worried that we were taking the heart out of education and turning, you know, people into what he called men without chests, which were just these kind of automatons that were had no moral compass or character. They had no idea of why they were learning and what they were learning and how it all created this, you know, systematic hole, you know. And this is exactly, I think, what Umbridge is talking about. We are going to basically turn you into people that don't think, that don't really know how to do anything, and that will be sheep that will follow what the ministry desires. And
we're turning you into something we should never be threatened by.
Exactly. And that is something that is so scary, in the idea that, you know, it's, you know, for me personally, it's why I've never loved that government is so involved with education, because any government can turn education any way it wants if we're not careful. And the, you know, the purpose of education is to be taught not just facts and figures, but so much more. So anyway, that's where I think JK is really coming from. And it was interesting to me, when I was reading this chapter, I was really seeing the connections with that essay, which is a fantastic essay, and I highly encourage anybody to read it, because it I think it holds weight for what we're even seeing again in our culture today, of like, you know, we need to go back to the roots of what education is meant for, you know. And I think we are kind of turning out people who don't have an understanding of, you know, basic facts along with anything else.
Well, it has a very dictator-like yep. feel, right? Like, the ministry is no longer a guiding force. It's now a dictatorship, right? Like, you will do what we say, how we say, or or we're going to destroy you, right? Like, and that's living proof as we're seeing it play out against Dumbledore and Harry. And, you know, the lies and the fact that the Order of the Phoenix has to pretend when they're in the ministry, and just the whole thing is just escalating to such a ridiculous level. And now it's in Hogwarts and trying to do the same to, you know, this institution that Harry loves so much, that this chapter ends on such a, or at least this section of the chapter ends on such a solemn note. Then they're released to go back to their common rooms. And if I remember correctly, Harry cannot get out of there fast enough. He just wants to get to the safety of the common room and the safety of the people he feels, you know, most supported by, because, you know, he can't imagine a Gryffindor turning on him. And, you know, thankfully Neville's there to save the day with the password, which is his weird, gross cactus thing, which I just love. I love that the cactus thing is the password.
Yes.
It makes me so happy.
That was awesome. Well, and, you know, it's interesting because we get to the boys' dormitory and a fight breaks out between Harry and Seamus, because Seamus is talking about how he had such an awful summer and it's all Harry's fault because his mother was reading the Daily Prophet and, you know, believing basically everything they said. And, you know, Harry comes face to face with the way in which, you know, he's been actually excluded from understanding what people were saying about him, because he wasn't really reading all of the Daily Prophet every day. He was just looking at the headlines and he missed all of that. And this is kind of what Hermione was trying to explain to him. And he gets face to face, literally face to face with somebody who has been experiencing this all summer and quote unquote suffering because of it. And Harry is slapped in the face with this idea of, you know, what people are truly believing about him. But on top of that, not only that, but he's also being slapped in the face and struck with what Dumbledore has been going through all summer as well, because if they're saying this about Harry and Harry has Dumbledore on his side, then they're saying the same thing about him. And realizing, oh, maybe Dumbledore's not happy with me for some reason, possibly, or, you know, like, there's this whole thought process that happens to Harry. And I think we end the chapter just on a really sour note, in the sense of we're starting to see the stakes of what this whole book is about, which is ministry and interference on the students and the education there at Hogwarts, and the way that it's going to be impacting everyone, and especially somebody like Harry and Dumbledore, who are holding to the truth and believing the truth and trying to get others to believe the truth, which is actually that, yes, Voldemort is back. We are all in danger, and yet nobody wants to listen to us. And standing on the side of truth when nobody wants to believe you, and all they want to do is ridicule you and make you feel stupid for, you know, saying what you're saying and believing what you believe, is a very difficult position to be in. And I think it leaves us in a, and much of this book is in a very melancholy place to be. It's dark and foreboding and depressing, honestly. And I think there's a real reason for that, which I'm going to love exploring for the rest of this book.
So the sort of interaction with Seamus, because Dean's parents are muggles, and I love his statement, like, and I'm not dumb enough to tell them someone got killed here last year. So it's interesting because this is, again, another instance where the sorting hat's right. You know, they're turning on each other, and that foundation and that strength and that support is already crumbling, right? We're an hour, 2 hours after the sorting hat speaks, and we're literally seeing it happen. But I feel like coming at this from maybe an adult perspective, or I even wonder if we had put Hermione in the room, if this interaction would have gone differently, because there is truth and there is a sense of what's real in Seamus's story. For if you have no other reason to believe the fact that the Daily Prophet isn't, and the ministry is not being honest, it is really difficult to believe anything else. and they have nothing else to go on. And that even if Seamus, because Seamus never says he agrees with the Daily Prophet. He never says he agrees with his mom. He's very careful to how he lays it out. And he's merely sharing that this made it very awkward and hard for him. So that is probably true. He is probably had a difficult time convincing his mom to let him go back. It probably was not pleasant for him, especially considering he is friends with Harry, to hear all these things and to have his beliefs and his friend challenged. And so looking at it from that perspective, it sucked. And Seamus has every right to be upset from a very personal standpoint. But at the same time, Harry is right to feel betrayed that, you know, Seamus didn't stand up for him more and believe in him. But that is a big ask for anyone, let alone kids that age. So it's such an interesting dynamic that I feel like Harry had such a strong reaction to. And I think we're going to see that more and more in this book, as we've already seen it in the past chapters, is just this emotional rage and this inability to deal with all that's happening to him right now, that he lashes out strongly at Seamus. So Seamus lashes out very strongly back. You know, this whole thing is really unpleasant. And I do like that even though Ron brings a little more energy to this argument, that he does say, no, I believe him. I believe him. I don't need anything else to make me believe him. I believe him. And so does my family. And that is such a powerful moment. And I feel like that's going to resonate with Seamus as we go forward. And I feel like in that moment, it did a little bit too, that no, I have blind faith. He didn't ask for him to share the same, but he just stood up for what he believed in. And it is such a powerful and emotionally charged moment, and such a sad one to sort of end this chapter on, knowing that Harry is feeling more and more alone, and that he had wished, and that we as readers wish, that Seamus could have come over to his side. But at the same time, this is what makes these books so great, is that Seamus is a flawed character like everyone else. He has the things he needs to learn. And it is, and it goes back to, you know, what Dumbledore said several books ago, it is not always easy to do the right thing. And we're seeing this play out every time. And that in this case, the easiest thing for Seamus to do is to believe and to go with the sheep and to trust the Daily Prophet and the government and his mom. And that is the easy thing to do, but it's not the right thing to do. It's just one of those character moments that you love how she's created it. You hate the situation you're in, but it's real. And I love it. And I hate it at the same time. I love and I hate it too.
Well, and it's not only the fact that we get Ron backing him up, but, you know, Neville does too.
Yeah.
And, you know, Harry.
And Neville's gran.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And Harry feels a real rush of gratitude towards Neville for backing him up as well. I mean, he knows that Ron's going to back him up. I mean, that's a given. But the fact that Neville just, you know, and somebody, Neville's not really particularly loquacious, right, with things, but he just speaks up and he says, you know, I believe you, and my gran and I both think what the Daily Prophet are doing are rubbish. You know, like, we even canceled our subscription because we believe Harry. And he just says it simply, and it leaves Harry with a real feeling of gratitude, and I enjoy that. You know, I really appreciate that, and I look forward to seeing the way in which, you know, Harry might be able to find other allies throughout this season, and I think that's going to be something really interesting. And I think, you know, we mentioned last chapter how we're opening up the doors for other characters to be a part of Harry's life, and I think Neville just helped open a door to continue to allow himself to be even more a part of Harry's life than he has before by what he just said, because it's hard to not want to be with people who, you know, think you're not a liar. So especially when
right.
they're not
and,
a lot
and
of
I
them.
Love, and I love, especially knowing what we as readers know about, you know, Neville's background and what he goes through, that like this speaks very deeply and personally to him. Right? Like, we know based on what we learned from Dumbledore before that, like, this is more than just a timid, awkward boy. This is a kid who's been through some equally traumatic instances, if not so more so than what Harry's been through. And for him to be able to sort of boldly trust him as well, knowing what's at stake for Neville, is
you know, he would have any reason to be as terrified as like Fudge, right? He has every right to feel like as yeah. in denial about everything that's happening, more so than probably any other character in this book. And he is willing to believe and willing to stand up. And that to me is that moment where you're like, Neville belongs in Gryffindor. And it's a quiet and a different kind of brave, but it is a brave that nobody else can understand. And I feel like Harry knowing that is he is so much even more grateful to have Neville on his side. And as readers, you have this like, I don't know, I had like a mom surge of pride when that happened, that Neville very calmly stepped in and put aside his own feelings and said, we believe him too. And yep. And that's hard, you know, like knowing how hard that had to be for him and his grand to come to that conclusion at some point. You love the reasonableness and you just know they're good people. And I had that mom like surge of pride when he said that. And I was like, you go, Neville.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that was that moment. It is kind of the one with Ron's, you know, with the way that Ron comes in and, you know, defends Harry, and then the fact that Neville does this too, it does leave you with a sense like, yes, there's a really melancholy chapter, especially here at the end, and it's kind of a downer at the end, but there are rays of hope. And I think that's the thing that this book really does. Through the depressive nature of a lot of this book, there are rays of hope where we see where the light is going to come through. And one of those places of light is somebody like Neville. And that's kind of beautiful because he's discounted by so many others. And yet, you know, in this moment, it's actually Neville that makes Harry feel better. And that's really cool. So.
And we have, it gives you such a different approach to how things can be different than what we think. That beautiful and brave and smart, they all look different for different people and they all come from different places. And I think that whenever she has kind of a moment to show you that, she does, and she allows you to see that in its own sense without it being like shoved in your face. Mm-hmm. And these, yep. This is one of those very beautiful moments that you just love. At least I loved it. So
yeah, no, I mean, I heartily agree with you. I'm so there with you with this one, and I can't wait to get into the rest of this book. We have so much that's going to happen. It's going to be so much fun. Drea, before we do that, though, we end this chapter. And if anybody wants to talk to you about the chapter or maybe their love for Neville or anything else, where can people find you online?
If you want to tell me how much you're dreading the next few chapters of this book like I am, you can find me on Twitter at PCFcheck or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you can find me under the name MattRushing02 on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Tumblr. You can also find me here on the network doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. We talk about a Star Wars topic each and every week. It's so much fun. We have so much going on this year as we've got the 20th anniversary of The Phantom Menace. We've got episode 9 coming out. So much happening there. Make sure you check it out. You can also find me over on the Trek FM network doing two shows, one with Chris Jones talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. It's called The Orb. Our latest episode is out, so check that out, please. We've got the 602 Club, which is our general geek show, as my friend Christy and I, she's my new co-host. We dive into all the different fandoms that we love. We just talked about Into the Spider-Verse, which was just a joy, so check that out. And you can find me on one more show, which is back for the year, which is Cinema Stories, and that's where my friend Courtney and I talk about films, but through the lens of faith. But Dre and I want to thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.